From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter Rodaut. It's Here and Now. Jeremy's off today. And that searing heat wave in the Southwest continues to fan wildfires across the region, especially in Southern California, where two new fires east of Los Angeles have led to the evacuation of several hundred homes. We'll be keeping an eye on that story.
But first, have you seen today's cover of the New York Daily News? It's gone viral. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. It's a blood-drenched U.S. Capitol building. The paper's editorial response to the Senate rejected four gun-related bills yesterday, just 8 days after the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Two of the measures, one from Democrats, one from Republicans, would have made it harder for suspected terrorists on watch lists to buy guns, what Democrats call no-fly, no-buy. In other words, if they can't fly because they're on the list, they shouldn't be able to buy the guns. Two others focused on expanding background checks. The Democrats' bill would have expanded them to include online and gun show sales. Elsa Chang is NPR's congressional correspondent in Washington. Elsa, it was thought the bills would fail, but still, what's been the reaction?
Well, right. I mean, it's been a foregone conclusion for days on the Hill that these measures would be defeated. And, you know, watching Senate Democrats yesterday, they held the same kind of press conference that they did in 2013 when gun control legislation failed after Sandy Hook. They hit the same notes of anger and disgust. And Republicans felt very much that these proposals were misguided, that the real conversation to have was one about counterterrorism, not about gun control. But it wasn't until I talked to family members of people who've been murdered by gun violence that a lot of the weariness, the weariness came through. Mm-hmm. I spoke with a woman yesterday. Her name's Erica Lafferty Smigelski. She's the daughter of Don Hucksprung, who was the principal at Sandy Hook and was murdered during those shootings. And, you know, before yesterday's vote, Erica was actually pointing out signs of progress to me that after 3 years, they have this national, massive national grassroots movement. They were able to flood senators' offices with 60,000 phone calls in barely a week after Orlando, which wasn't quite the case so soon after Sandy Hook. And getting gun votes scheduled took only about 4 days after Orlando, whereas it took 4 months after Sandy Hook. So Erica was saying, look at how much has changed. But then I talked to her after the vote, and there was this moment when she was recounting sitting up in the Senate gallery watching the vote last night and, you know, watching senators vote down gun control once again. And it was this very depressing reminder to her about how little has actually changed.
Well, Chris W. Cox, who's the NRA's chief lobbyist, tweeted out after the votes that we all agree that terrorists should not be allowed to purchase or possess firearms. He's talking about the bills that would have made people on watch lists, possible terrorists, unable to buy guns. He said, we all agree terrorists shouldn't be able to buy guns, but we should all agree that law-abiding Americans who are wrongly put on a government list should not be denied their constitutional right to due process. So there's the divide, or part of the divide right there. But we know that there is a new bill being worked on by Maine Senator Susan Collins. What's in that bill?
Right. So Susan Collins' bill would basically prevent people on two smaller, more scrutinized lists from buying guns. So the terror watch list is this massive database that contains a bunch of sublists. What Susan Collins' bill would do is focus on the no-fly list, which is a smaller sublist, and the secondary security screening selection list. It's a mouthful, but that second list is a list of people who are eligible to be pulled out of line at the airport for closer inspection. And the idea behind her bill is, you know, there's just more reason to be concerned about these particular people, from, you know, making sure that these people don't get guns. The terror watch list, I think it's something like 900,000 more foreign nationals and plenty more than that. And that's why Democrats are a little bit unsure about the bill, because they say it doesn't capture a lot of people who very well could be suspected terrorists and would be free to get guns under the Collins bill. But we don't know if there's even going to be a vote on Susan Collins' bill just yet. And as far as, you know, whether she'll even get enough support for it to pass, a lot of senators as of last night still hadn't even seen a copy of the bill, so on either side of the aisle. So it's not clear how much support there is in the chamber.
Well, so what do you think happens going forward? Just briefly, how do you see this playing out in the election year? Guns and gun control and gun safety, gun rights had not really been part of the dialogue.
Right. I mean, Hillary Clinton has made it a huge issue. Gun control advocates vowed last night, you know, I was hearing the phrase, we're going to remember in November. They're going to make this an issue. But it's hard to know how much it'll break through, because they did try that in 2014 after gun control legislation failed after Sandy Hook. They tried to make it a real issue. And the tough thing is figuring out how many voters out there see gun control as the single driving issue that would determine their choice, their decisions at the polls. Gun control advocates poured millions of dollars into this issue last election cycle, and it's really hard to say it broke through, but maybe 2016 will be different.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Elsa Chang. Elsa, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, guns accounted for the death of 33,636 Americans in 2013. And more than 21,000 of those deaths, 63%, were suicides. Now, in the field of suicide prevention, most clinicians are not properly trained to assess and treat people for suicidal risk. A school of social work in Boston is trying to change that. Lynn Joliker from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you here today?
Yeah, so I was on the inpatient unit for like a week or so, and I was
this
there.
This isn't a real counseling session. It's a midterm exam.
Because I was pretty depressed and was like cutting myself with a scissor.
Laura Goodman and Justin Murata took this course as part of their master's degrees in social work at Simmons College in Boston this spring. They learned how to determine whether clients are suicidal, and if they are, how to respond. Goodman and Murata found out early in the course that it's best to come right out and ask clients whether they're thinking about suicide or have a suicide plan in place. The mock therapy sessions allow students to show their professors how comfortable they are having that conversation.
So when you were cutting yourself and you were brought to inpatient, was the idea to try and kill yourself?
I think, yeah, that time it was. And it's only confusing because I cut a lot and I have thoughts of suicide a lot.
After the 10-minute exam was over, Murata realized he didn't ask his patient about any access to guns.
And I knew the whole time. I just wanted to find an appropriate way.
Yeah.
And I was like,
Assistant Professor Kim O'Brien has taught students it's crucial to ask that question because having a gun in the home increases the risk of suicide. But O'Brien understands that conversation can take time.
Exactly. You don't be like, oh, you have a gun, like, right away.
Right.
Exactly. So that was going to be one thing. Another thing I was going to say you'd want to be asking about down the road is, like, substance use.
And
because O'Brien says when she received her master's in social work, she didn't feel adequately trained to work with suicidal clients. She says she only got that training while working at Boston Children's Hospital. But she wasn't alone in feeling unprepared. National surveys have found most social work graduate students receive four or fewer hours of instruction in suicide prevention and intervention. Most other health professionals receive no advanced training.
I would say it's a huge problem.
Joanna Almeida is an assistant professor of social work at Simmons College.
I knew that there wasn't a class dedicated exclusively to suicide here at Simmons, and I thought that was a gap in the curriculum.
Almeida says her students were shocked to learn that each year suicide kills more people than homicide or car crashes. There were 42,000 suicides in the U.S. in 2014. It's the 10th leading cause of death overall and the second leading cause of death for those 10 to 34 years old.
So basically, you're trying to challenge the belief that the patient's situation cannot get better.
Visiting instructor Laika Aguinaldo teaches specific methods of intervening to prevent suicide. She told the class about an experience in which she asked a client to make a visual art piece highlighting the patient's reasons for living. Student Julia Bellotta wanted some clarification.
What were some of the things that tipped you off that you needed to do that intervention? Was it just the fact that she was expressing suicidal ideation?
My issue with this client in particular was that this is her first time disclosing the suicidality to anybody. When she went to the emergency room, she said she had a panic attack, and they missed the suicidal thoughts.
Student Emily Wolcott says the course helped her feel more comfortable counseling suicidal adolescents in her internship at a community health center. But she acknowledges the work is stressful.
I think the challenges are really determining someone's level of safety and what level of care they need. Feeling that kind of responsibility is like very intense.
A recurring theme throughout the course is empathy, really listening to people who are suicidal and helping them find a way to manage their suicidal thoughts. Again, student Justin Murata.
If you can bring your real self to the table, I think that's super important. I think that especially particularly in working with teens that they can read right through you and whether you're being genuine and sincere versus, you know, saying a script that you say to everybody.
Professor Kim O'Brien wants social workers in training to remember suicide is preventable.
A lot of our students come in thinking, well, it's someone's choice. If they, you know, are going to kill themselves, then they're going to kill themselves and there's nothing I can do about it. The whole thing we want them to come away from this course is saying that's false. Our goal in our work should be zero suicides. It might happen where we lose a client to suicide. I have. But that doesn't mean that it couldn't have been prevented in some way.
More than 90% of social workers encounter a suicidal client in their careers. For these new social workers who have advanced knowledge and a special interest in suicide prevention, that number may end up even higher. For Here and Now, I'm Lynn Joliker.
On Saturday, Donald Trump held a fundraiser in the former home of Barry Goldwater, the Republican who lost the 1964 presidential election in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson. The event once again drew comparisons between the men. Both are known for being outspoken and creating tension within the Republican Party. But the late senator's widow said Goldwater would be appalled by Trump raising money in their former home. Barry Goldwater Jr. joins us now from Phoenix. He's Goldwater's son. And Mr. Goldwater, what do you make of Trump's visit to your father's house?
Well, a home is only where your family lives. My family doesn't live there anymore. It's somebody else's house, and he can do what he wants to. But replying to Susan Goldwater's remarks, let me remind you that Susan Goldwater is a Democrat. She supports Hillary Clinton. So I'm not surprised at what she had to say, and you can take it with a grain of salt.
But what would your father think about Donald Trump?
I don't know. I can't really interpret what his thoughts were. He was a party person. He believed in his party and supporting his party. And I remember him oftentimes saying to those who didn't like the candidate is to get him in elected and then try to change him. So he was he would be supportive of Donald Trump after he has won the Republican nomination. And he would say to everybody, come on, let's get on board. He's our candidate. Let's work for him and get him into office, and then if we want to, we can try to change him.
Many of the connections around these two men have evolved around your father's rejection of the Civil Rights Act, and they say his critics would say that it cost him dearly, especially among African Americans. And there are parallels, some say, to today's rhetoric with Donald Trump on Latinos and immigration. Do you see any parallels there?
Well, I really don't. My father was misinterpreted, and there was a lesson to be learned, is don't let your opponents define who you are. My father was very much of an integrationist. He integrated the National Guard in Arizona, the bus stops, his own department store, the airports. He was a member, one of the founding members of the NAACP. He got one of the highest rewards from the Urban League. He voted for every civil rights bill that came to the United States Senate, except the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And he did that because of constitutional grounds. So he was very much of an integrationist. He was well liked by all the different nationalities here in Arizona. So Trump, on the other hand, he's made some statements that are not very attractive.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that your father was better on the issue of race than Donald Trump?
Oh, but I think much better. Sure he was. Yeah. I mean, let's face it. My father has a record. He spent 30 years in the United States Senate where he had to vote and register his beliefs and his feelings about such things. And as I said, he's voted for every Civil Rights Act that it was ever presented to the United States Senate.
And I also want to ask you about this idea of anti-establishment. Your father, in 1964, was considered to be anti-establishment. Of course, he was a serving senator, so he was in some way a Washington insider. But there's been so much talk about Donald Trump as this anti-establishment guy. Connections there? Can you make those?
Well, Donald Trump is very unorthodox. Everything I knew about politics went out the window when Donald Trump came onto the scene. He's not a polished politician. He speaks his mind. My father did the same thing. But my father, I think, was a different kind of person who was thoughtful, who was serious and was principled, who was sensitive to other people. I think what we have with Donald Trump is somebody who is speaks his mind and is appealing to the masses. The people are frustrated. They're angry, and they're looking for a leader, somebody who's going to start putting America first for a change. He may be unorthodox and may be somewhat glib in the way he says things, but that's Donald Trump. That's his personality.
That's Barry Goldwater Jr. speaking to us on the line from Phoenix, Arizona. Thank you very much.
All right, Peter, anytime.
And for a deeper look, we're joined now by Elizabeth Shermer. She's an assistant professor of history at Loyola University Chicago, and she edited the book Barry Goldwater and the Remaking of the American Political Landscape. Elizabeth, what do you think? Is this comparison between the two men fair?
I actually don't think it is. I mean, on the surface, it looks like it is, right? They both seem, especially a recent, recent things that we've learned, that Donald Trump is not quite the businessman that he's made himself about to be. Barry Goldwater was not the retailer. He really inherited that his father's department store and turned it over. There's also a lot of excitement about these two candidates. There's also a distrust about who either now or back then was sort of the established figures in the GOP. And they really seem to be dividing the party, right? The Republican Party, but also the potential of wooing away disaffected voters, particularly from the Democratic Party in both cases. And also, they both seemed for their particular time very coarse. You know, there's a lot of concern right now about Trump meeting with evangelicals. Can he make them feel okay about his multiple divorces? Barry Goldwater styling himself as, I am not of that elite Nelson Rockefeller, patrician world. Instead, I'm a cowboy conservative. Ignore the pool in the background of me sort of behind the Arizona landscape. But it doesn't really work when you actually get past that because, Barry Goldwater, by the time he's running for president, by the 60s, he's an established politician.
Yeah,
like, that's really
senator.
What he made his career. Yeah, and Trump is not. Goldwater is actually drafted, into being a president, but he's a figure in this. And Trump really did come out of nowhere and really sort of surprised a lot of people.
Well, let's put this into some historical context. Going back to the 1964 convention when Goldwater received his party's nomination, he had just beaten Nelson Rockefeller, who gave a defiant speech in San Francisco decrying extremist elements of the party.
These are people who have nothing in common with Americanism. The Republican Party must repudiate these people.
Rockefeller there referring, of course, to Goldwater, and here's Goldwater's response. It's now a famous line.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Professor Shermer, just remind us what Goldwater stood for and also what his relationship with the party was. Because right there, I can see why some people are drawing comparisons between 2016 and 1964, this intense split between the party.
Well, the way that we have to think about Barry Goldwater and the early conservative movement sort of coming, around him, or eventually would sort of make him his candidate because he's a part of a broad movement, is that they're standing for a repudiation of modern liberalism, New Deal liberalism. And they hated Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller, called Me Too Republicans, or liberal and moderate Republicans, who seem to be, and this is Goldwater's very famous indictment of Eisenhower, that he was giving America a dime store. Or New Deal, right? Mm. And so what you see is, this is actually how Goldwater moves from a career in retail into a career in politics, this idea that we will actually make a, it's the story of the 64, the tagline of the 64 campaign, a choice. A choice between the liberalism of the Democratic Party and something else with the Republican Party. And what Goldwater is actually a part of is a broad movement to actually find a place for a very decisively anti-liberal party platform. And also, where would it be housed? Would it be housed in what Strom Thurmond thought would be, the states' right Southern Democrat or states' right Democratic Party, or would it be within within the Republican Party itself. And the wars were actually within the Republican Party in the 50s and into the 60s about what that party would stand for. So, but he's still a creature of the party. He was always a registered Republican. And that's so different from Trump.
Well, I want to go back briefly to 1964. Because there is an important conversation to have around race, not only at that time, but also this year. We heard Barry Goldwater Jr. defend his father's vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He made the point that this was about defending the Constitution and that, in fact, he had good relationships with African Americans. But still, I mean, a lot of historians would say that that was the moment in time that split the Republican Party from the African American vote. I mean, what kind of historical connections can you make there with what we're seeing in Donald Trump and his campaign?
Well, and the interesting thing about Barry Goldwater is one of the things that people don't know about his early political career is that he was actually working a little bit with the NAACP. In fact, Phoenix school districts were actually desegregated actually a year before Brown. And what's interesting about that is for him, the way that Goldwater would talk about it is that he found Jim Crow so repugnant, and he connected it to the fact that he was half Jewish. His dad was Jewish, and actually until his star began to rise, he was excluded, right? He was restricted from where he could actually sort of circulate. However, as his African-American butler said, Goldwater had a blindness to understanding it. And so it is true that Goldwater, you know, is wrapping this all up in the question of states' rights and local control. His main concern actually in 64 was that the 64 Civil Rights Act would put an unprecedented amount of government power over hiring decisions. So it was really that background of that he was a business conservative first and foremost, but speaks also to his way that he couldn't see the dynamics and the perniciousness of race and racism and inequality.
Well, it is easy to look back on history and to make comparisons. John Dean, the former White House counsel to Richard Nixon, said in Newsweek that all comparisons are off the mark and they are nonsense. But Elizabeth Shermer, thanks nonetheless for going there with us. You're an assistant professor of history at Loyola University Chicago. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Donald Trump's just-released fundraising figures show his campaign raised just $3.1 million in May, ending the month with $1.3 million in the bank. That wouldn't even buy you 10 seconds on the Super Bowl. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton's campaign had $42 million in May and has just launched an 8-state, $17 million ad campaign featuring television spots like this one.
She would grow up to be one of the most recognizable women in the world. But less well known are the causes that have been at the center of her life. After law school, she could have gone to a big law firm. Instead, she went to work for the Children's Defense Fund, helping get disabled kids out of the shadows and into their local schools.
I mean, we've been hearing what the fundraising numbers say about the race, but now let's just take a second to hear what the ads are saying with Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. John, and what the segments on what the dollars mean, they're saying that it doesn't mean anything because Donald Trump is a different kind of candidate and maybe doesn't need ads. But let's talk about this huge Clinton campaign. She's got two positive spots. We just heard a little of one negative one. What's the thinking behind this?
Well, she's got two objectives here, really. One is to drive up Donald Trump's negatives, which he does a pretty good job of by himself. Mm-hmm. The other is to drive down her own negatives, which are fairly high. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll see the people in these eight battleground states will see a lot more of the positive ads than the negative one.
Well, these are from the Clinton campaign, and they are running in states where Priorities USA, a pro-Clinton super PAC, has also spent $8 million already on ads, and it looks like they're going to be taking up some of the negative pounding. Here's one of them.
Who are you consulting with consistently so that you're ready on day one?
I'm speaking with myself, number one.
This is the Trump theory on war. I'm really good at war. I love war in a certain way.
So they are attacking Donald Trump. What's the political geometry here?
Well, usually what the candidate wants to let the outside group do most of the dirty work so that any blowback might not land on them, would stick on the outside group. A lot of times people don't really know who's running the ad and who's not. So on the flip side, there's a pro-Trump super PAC that's running an anti-Clinton ad that shows Bill Clinton from the 1990s and Hillary Clinton from now.
But I want to say one thing.
We turned over everything.
I want you to listen to me.
I did not send classified material.
Not a single time.
And I did not receive.
Never.
Boy, this is all over CNN. It's all over MSNBC. It's pretty devastating.
It is, but the money behind it isn't near what Clinton is spending on her ads. And this is the problem. There's a real imbalance here. Donald Trump just sent out an emergency email on Saturday asking for $100,000 to put ads on the air. $100,000. Hillary Clinton's spending 170 times that. Mm. So he's really bringing a knife to a gunfight so far.
Well, but yes, but again, you know, people say maybe he won't need the advertising as much. He hasn't in the past. But to the Clinton campaign, all that money, it's not even July. Is it early? I mean, what does it say that they are spending that money?
It is early, but they're taking a page from the Barack Obama playbook in 2012, which is to hit early and define your opponent before he gets to define himself.
Yeah, and it worked in that case in 2012. We'll see about now. Here now, media analyst John Carroll, mass communications professor, by the way, at Boston University. We'll have a link to his campaign outsider blog at hereandnow.org. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
On Thursday, Britain will vote on whether to leave the European Union. The latest polls show a tilt toward people wanting to stay in. How are college students thinking? Well, let's ask two of them. Dominic Norcliffe Brown is studying politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford University. And Grace Neefsi just graduated from Oxford. She wants to be an accountant. And Grace, I hear you've been teetering. How do you think you'll vote?
So I've kind of teetered around the middle for a while, but I think I'm going to be voting to leave the EU.
To leave the EU. Why is that?
The biggest reason for me is that whilst I don't necessarily disagree with having some form of cooperation with other European countries, I think that the EU has kind of overstepped and kind of come into too many areas. And also, given what's happened with the Eurozone and so on, that it's sort of failing as a structure.
Mm. Do you think that leaving the EU would help you in your future, in your job prospects?
I don't know. I think that most people on both sides would accept that there will definitely be some sort of short-term economic loss. But I'm not convinced by the sort of long-term economic scaremongering that the Remain side have kind of been talking about. And I think that there's a whole world out there for us to trade with and engage with in business. And I think the EU is sort of, you know, it's getting left behind in terms of the world of work and business, and it's not the most important thing to the UK anymore.
Mm. Well, according to The Guardian, young voters like yourself are pretty much overwhelmingly in favor of staying in the European Union. Do you feel like an outsider with your opinion amongst your peers?
Yeah, a little bit. And I definitely think with some of my peers who maybe haven't been to university, there's definitely more of an even split.
Well, what do you make of this argument that on immigration, that it would be good for Britain's economy to restrict immigration by leaving the EU?
Okay, well, I think that the immigration argument has in many ways taken a bit of a like nasty turn, and we have a lot of issues in the UK, for example, with workers only offering jobs to agencies, to EU workers, that I think that does warrant some concern with the current levels of immigration.
Dominic, Grace is your friend there. She's in favor of leaving the European Union. You, though, are not.
No, I'm not. I think the EU has a lot of problems, and they need to be sorted out. However, the question is whether or not we would now be better leaving or staying in. And I think while we can look at the problems of the EU and recognise them, I think overall we'd be in a lot worse position if we were to leave. I mean, firstly, if somebody wants to study in Europe, and there's a risk that a lot of these programmes will become more expensive for British students. Also, of course, jobs-wise, there's a lot of companies that do work mainly in the common market, and a lot of them would probably relocate actually to somewhere like Germany if we were to leave.
Well, I was talking with Grace about how many people your age are in favour of staying like you are. But there is a fair amount of apathy amongst young voters in Britain. They don't often go to the polls. I just wonder, what is it like there on campus at Oxford? Are people passionate about this? Are they sitting around at the pubs and drinking beer and debating it?
Yeah, I think, you know, most people I know are voting. Most have made up their mind one way or the other. And yeah, definitely people are going down to the pub and talking about it.
Do you think you and Grace will remain friends over this? Or is it just more of a good-hearted political disagreement?
Well, I suppose it depends who wins, really.
Dominic Norcliffe Brown, you just finished your second year at the University of Oxford in England. We also spoke with Grace Neefsi, who recently graduated. They are two friends with differing opinions on this issue of Brexit. Britain will vote on Thursday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A Massachusetts family is marking a somber anniversary today, the death of a beloved son in a distant war. That event was also the start of a special relationship between Here and Now's Alex Ashlock and the father of that young man.
On June 21, 2006, Army Sergeant Jared Monty died fighting on a remote mountaintop in Afghanistan. A rocket-propelled grenade cut him down on his third attempt to rescue another soldier who had been wounded in a firefight with the Taliban. 3 years later, Jared Monty was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. During the White House ceremony, President Obama said what Jared Monty did that day was not a moment of passing courage.
He was the kid at school who, upon seeing a student eating lunch alone, would walk over and befriend him. He was the teenager who cut down a spruce tree in his yard so a single mom in town would have a Christmas tree for her children. He even bought the ornaments and the presents.
Jared's death devastated his large Italian family. Perhaps no one took it harder than his father, Paul. And he's the reason this story remains so important to me 10 years later. After Jared was buried at the Massachusetts National Cemetery on Cape Cod, his father wondered why there were no American flags on the graves there for Memorial Day or Veterans Day. Officials told Paul they didn't allow the flags because they made it too difficult to maintain the grounds. But Paul Monty is a pretty persuasive guy. He got them to change the rules. That's when I met him for the first time. It was the Saturday before Memorial Day in 2011. Paul had put out the call for volunteers to help him place American flags on all of the thousands of graves at the cemetery. Hundreds of people responded. He called it Operation Flags for Vets.
I know he would have done something like this, but he would have done it in a very different way.
What do you mean?
Jared never liked any kind of notoriety at all. All his medals went in a sock drawer. No one ever saw them. So he wouldn't have done this in a big venue. He would have found a warehouse somewhere with an unlocked door and appropriated or borrowed some flags, come down here in the middle of the night, put them all in, and someone would have come the next day and say, wow, someone decorated the cemetery.
I think I have this right. Do you still drive Jared's truck?
Yes, I do. There it is. It's him. It's got his DNA all over it. I love driving it because it reminds me of him, though I don't need the truck to remind me of him. I think about him every hour of every day.
It's a Dodge 4x4 Ram 1500. It's got the decals, the 10th Mountain Division, 82nd Airborne Division, American flags, a bumper sticker for the Jared Monty Scholarship Fund.
My gold star plate on there. Go Army. Support the troops. And though it only gets pretty bad mileage, I'm happy driving it. He's with me. But he's with me all the time anyway.
Connie Harrington, a songwriter in Nashville, was listening to Here and Now the day that interview aired. She was inspired to co-write this song.
I drive your truck. I roll every window down and I burn up. Every back road in this town I find a field. I tear it up.
Country singer Lee Brice recorded I Drive Your Truck, and in 2013 it was named Song of the Year by the Country Music Association. I spoke to Paul Monty at the cemetery again after his very personal story of grief was shared in a very public way.
Did you ever think that what you started in 2011 would turn into what it's become?
No, not at all. It's way more than I ever expected down here. It's just beautiful.
Does it keep you going?
Of course it does. I come down here and I see these people here. I see people in their 80s here that want to do this. And then I see these little kids.
And yeah, Cub Scouts.
Smiles. They all have smiles on their face that, you know, yay, I want to do this. I'm happy to do this. That's what's so meaningful.
Over the years, following this story has become more than an act of reporting for me. I now drive my truck to Cape Cod to help haul the bins of American flags out to the various sections of the National Cemetery. I do it for my friend Paul Monty, whose son Army Sergeant Jared Monty was killed in Afghanistan 10 years ago today. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlaw.
I drive your truck. I roll every window down and I burn up every back road in this town. I find a field, I tear it up till all the pain's a cloud of dust. Yes, sometime, brother, sometime.
According to an article published in Politico today, Apple CEO Tim Cook will hold a fundraiser next week with Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan. And that is turning a head or two. It comes just days after Apple announced it's pulling its support of the upcoming Republican National Convention, citing inflammatory comments from Donald Trump. Meanwhile, over at Facebook, yesterday the company's shareholders voted to retain the board members, including billionaire Peter Thiel, a Donald Trump delegate, and the guy who just funded the Hulk Hogan lawsuit that took down Gawker. For more on Silicon Valley politics, let's turn to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Edmund Lee is managing editor of Recode. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
And start with Apple CEO Tim Cook. He's been politically vocal, especially on social issues. But, you know, your sense on these liberal views he expresses, joining forces with Speaker Paul Ryan.
It is interesting. It did turn heads, as you guys said, top of the segment. What's interesting on top of that is Apple itself as a company, and I know this is Tim Cook himself that's hosting the fundraiser. Apple itself as a company doesn't have a PAC, political action committee, in D.C. the way that, say, Facebook and Google do. And so Apple as a company just hasn't been the most sort of politically active. So it's interesting that it's the CEO who's taking this step of, you know, basically trying to court both sides of the aisle here. And I think also the fact that it's not Donald Trump himself, but Speaker Ryan, who in a way has sort of represented sort of the established part of the GOP.
Yeah, but the money, you know, will go to their convention most likely. And, you know, we remember Donald Trump called on a boycott of Apple products because of its stance on encryption. He also, you know, took some shots at Apple and Tim Cook for using Chinese manufacturers.
Right.
Although we remember that, you know, most big corporations do spread their fundraising dollars on both sides of the aisle.
They do. And, you know, I think this overture on the part of Cook is to recognize what is traditionally done with companies and important people like Cook himself in terms of, you know, appealing to, speaking to, courting, politicking with both sides. And I think that's ultimately important for any person or any company that wants to do business and sort of have a voice, have their issues aired out.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that Apple doesn't have its own PAC, Political Action Committee. Google and Facebook do. What do they do?
So a big part, the two big areas right now that both for Google and Facebook and others, other tech companies in D.C. when they're lobbying, net neutrality and immigration. So net neutrality, as you know, it's important for them because they want it to be neutral. They don't want to have any tax on them from the carriers, the mm-hmm. broadband providers, you know, in terms of what types of content get filtered through. And so far, net neutrality is the law of the land. Second part, immigration. These guys are starved for engineers. There aren't enough engineers in this country, and so they tend to get them from overseas, and they want that to be easier. They want it to be more open and more available to be able to tap into that talent. And these are the primary issues right now for Silicon Valley companies when they lobby.
Right, when they lobby. Well, let's talk about Facebook. Its annual shareholder meeting. Two big things. Let's start with Peter Thiel, billionaire investor,
right.
Co-founder of PayPal. A lot of people were calling on him to be voted off the Facebook board of directors because of his role in funding the Hulk Hogan, secretly funding that lawsuit.
Secretly.
Yeah. So tell us more about that. And why do you think he stayed?
Well, so Facebook had said, you know, a while back that when the Peter Thiel news came about, that he's going to stay on the board. They felt it's important to have a diverse board, not just in terms of background, but in terms of their political views, especially for Facebook as a network, as a service, really, to regular people. They want it to be open to everyone, which means there's going to be tons of people on the left and people on the right. And so they don't want to discriminate either way. And they see that Thiel represents at least, you know, one side of that equation. I think what's troubling, though, for people on the other side is that he's, in funding these lawsuits, he's acting as sort of a regulator for media. He's decided Gawker shouldn't be a legitimate news organization, so therefore he's funded these suits against him. But the criticism is, why should he get to decide? And then you wonder, his seat on Facebook's board, is he sort of turning the dials in different ways as well? So that's the fear anyway.
And he had the initial anger at Gawker because Gawker had outed him years ago. And so this was a personal campaign. Well, so there's that. But finally, a big vote from Facebook's in its annual shareholder meeting on how the company divides its stock. It added a new class of stock. It basically allows founder Mark Zuckerberg to maintain ultimate control of the company. Tell us more about that.
Right. So basically, you know, he has control, but he also, you know, vowed to give away his ownership, say, for his charity work. And in order to do that, he had to create this new share class so that he can maintain power while also selling off the shares that don't have voting power. So allows him to do both those things. At the end of the day, he still makes all the decisions. And I think that's the key thing here.
Okay. Edmund Lee, managing editor of Recode, with the latest on Facebook, but also news that Apple CEO Tim Cook is going to hold a fundraiser next week with Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan. We'll be watching that as well. Ed, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.